Good morning and welcome to Cox Media Houston's Public Affairs Show, FYI. My name is Susie Hanks. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and with us today is Dr. Kathy Eng. She is the professor or a professor of gastrointestinal medical oncology and one of the founders of MD Anderson's annual Scope 5K. And so, good morning, Dr. Eng. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's so great to have you here. This is a very important thing that we're talking about. I'm sure that when people first hear we are going to talk about colorectal cancer, they're like, eh. But this is super important and very interesting, and there's a lot of great things that we're going to be talking about this morning. But I also want to talk about this Scope 5K, which is a fundraiser we're going to talk about a couple times that you are one of the founders of. It's coming up here pretty soon, so tell us about that.
So the Scope race was created. It's our 12th year. Specifically to help promote colorectal cancer awareness and screening, and it stands for Sprint for Colorectal Prevention and Education.
And oncology. It just so happens to be SCOPE, which is kind of a play on words.
Yes, it is. And it takes place on Saturday, March 25th. It actually was started by myself as well as one of our former research nurses just because of her interest in colorectal cancer awareness because it impacted one of her family members. And I think it really just emphasizes the importance of screening. This is one of the most preventable cancers in reality, and not enough people actually get screened. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that's when most people are diagnosed much later in stage.
And so the sprint is on the 25th. Where is it?
It occurs directly on the MD Anderson campus. And so it's going to be right by the right on Holcomb. So if you go to the main campus on Saturday morning, you'll see a lot of signs.
Okay. And how do people sign up or get information about it?
There is a website, www.ndanderson.org /scope.
Mm-hmm. And S-C-O-P-E.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. So we're going to talk about colorectal cancer. First of all, what is it?
So colorectal cancer actually is a cancer that basically starts with a benign appearing polyp, which is basically an outgrowth of your colon, and that takes about 5 to 10 years for the polyp to become cancerous, and that's why it's really important to get a colonoscopy, which is really considered the gold standard still. If a polyp is noted on a colonoscopy, it would be removed by a polypectomy. If it's too large, you may need to go to surgery, but most of the polyps are removed during the colonoscopy, and that can actually save your life.
Are we talking about, large intestine, small intestine, colon, rectum?
So it would be inclusive of both the colon and the rectum. So the large intestine and the rectum.
Okay. And so are there different types or is there just a certain type?
The majority of colorectal cancer we largely put into one category. We do separate out into colon and rectum just because rectal carcinoma may require radiation therapy. We are actually, with more research, we are trying to break it down to various subtypes, but that category largely lies in regards to treatment purposes in the more advanced stage, so okay. The metastatic stage 4 setting.
Tell me how it starts. Are there different, risk factors, things that you do, your health, or is it just, how does it begin?
So for the majority of patients, it's completely sporadic. There's a very small minority of patients that are at risk because they have a family history, and that's about 5 to 7% of all patients. And then there's some patients with a history of inflammatory bowel disease, such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, that are more prone to developing colon cancer. But the majority of patients, about 75% of patients, will have sporadic development of colorectal cancer. And for those patients, that's the big question. Why does this happen? We actually don't know exactly what is the exact mechanism because it appears to be very, very heterogeneous due to multiple factors. Everyone keeps asking me about diet, if that's the sole culprit. And I would say it's not just diet. Obviously, a healthy diet is important. But there's lots of data regarding fiber and whether or not red meat and smoked foods and, those type of things can impact the development of colorectal cancer. But in fact, I think it's just largely multiple factors in and of itself.
Yeah.
And the important thing is to start getting screened starting at the age of 50 unless you have a known family history.
So 50 is the age.
50 is As soon as your 50th birthday happens, you should consider getting screened. And in fact, in African Americans, there's been some data to show that you might want to consider getting screened sooner, starting at the age of 45.
Okay. You mentioned something about these polyps, and they start out as benign. What makes it change?
It just undergoes various changes over time, and there's various steps through the process. But that it takes about 5 to 10 years for that polyp to become cancerous, and so that's why it's very, very important to get screened.
Mm-hmm. And so why are we starting at 50? What is the because they just kind of happen when you get older, or?
The average age patient is about 67, 68 in the U.S., and so taking into account the development of the polyps and the time frame for the development of cancer, I believe based upon prior data, 50 appeared to be the most reasonable age. We are very focused at our institution. One of my research interests is the very young patient population. They represent less than 15% of all patients, those being less than 50, but the majority of cases will be recommended screening starting at 50. If you do have a first degree relative, though, with a history of colon cancer, you're supposed to get screened 10 years earlier than their diagnosis, though.
And do you do it every year?
No. So everyone's very concerned because of the PrEP, and I don't think anyone really wants to talk about colorectal cancer, and everyone thinks that the PrEP is horrible and they don't want to undergo the PrEP. But the reality is if your colonoscopy is clean, you don't have any risk factors, you probably don't need another one for another 8 to 10 years.
Okay, so starting at 50, do the first one, get through it, and then it's probably not going to resurface again for a while. When you talk about the PrEP, a lot of people, you know, you hear horror stories, but I also hear from people that it's changing and things are getting easier. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, my understanding is, you know, at our institution, I think every institution, every facility has their own preference for what they would like for the PrEP. But in fact, there are lots of different options. Before, you used to have to drink like 2 gallons of solution the night before and to fast and all that. But there are better PrEPs nowadays. At least that's what I've heard from my patients that have had access to some of these newer PrEPs. But they don't have to drink as much. There's different flavors. It's much more tolerable. And the reality is that PrEP is so important to be adequate, because if you have an inadequate PrEP, you're going to have to get the colonoscopy repeated.
Oh, yikes. So you want a clean slate in there, basically.
Definitely. Yeah. And the most important thing, honestly, is just to do some type of screening. So I mentioned colonoscopy is the gold standard, but there's something called a virtual colonoscopy, which is like a CAT scan that gives you a 3D image of the colon. However, if a polyp is found, you still have to undergo a colonoscopy to remove that polyp.
Yeah.
There's a flexible sigmoidoscopy, but that only will give you visualization of predominantly the left side of the colon, so you're going to miss the transverse colon, which is the mid portion, and then the right side of the colon. So we don't necessarily want a flexible sigmoidoscopy as our only test. And then even just testing the stool for blood in your primary care physician's office, that's the first step. Mm-hmm. So just any type of screening, it would be highly encouraged.
I remember back in, I don't know, maybe this is 30 years ago, when Katie Couric's husband, he died of colorectal cancer, and she went and did the colonoscopy live on the air, and everybody was just shocked at this. But that really kind of was a breakthrough, wasn't it?
I definitely think she helped to get the word out. I mean, everyone knows Katie Couric, and it was such a horrible thing that happened with her and her husband, because he was very young when he was diagnosed and unfortunately succumbed to the disease. But yes, I thought that was very, very encouraging for her to actually do the colonoscopy. We need more individuals to advocate for a colonoscopy to be completed. I mean, if you have insurance, it is covered. It is part of your standard screening tests, just like a mammogram is for a woman. It's just for some reason not enough individuals think about it. Not even just the individuals. Sometimes the primary care physicians forget to remind their patients. Mm-hmm. And it's so, so important, because this is a preventable cancer. And unfortunately, it's the second leading cause of cancer death for men and women combined.
Wow. And it's so preventable, and it's just all about detection.
Correct.
Can you explain what a colonoscopy is for people who may not know?
Sure. So basically, a scope is introduced usually by a gastroenterologist, and you will be anesthetized. I want people to know that they will be asleep and they're not going to be awake during the whole procedure. Let's just start off the day before. You have to fast for a period. You have to do the PrEP, and that's to clean out the bowel just for good visualization. The next day you'll go in, you'll meet with the anesthesiologist, you'll meet your gastroenterologist, and basically while you're sleeping, the scope will be introduced through your bottom to the rectum. and then it will be moved up through the left side of the colon, across the transverse colon, which is the mid portion, and then down to the right side of the colon. And a complete colonoscopy is when you've been able to reach all the way to the cecum, which is the bottom of the right side of the colon near the appendix. Once that's been completed, you've had a full colonoscopy. And once again, they'll look at all the, if they see any polyps. And certain polyps are obviously a little bit, there's different types of polyps. There's tubular polyps, which are more like a mushroom shape. So they're easy to detect and see and remove. But there's polyps that are a little bit harder to see, called sessile polyps, which are flat polyps. And so those polyps can be a bit challenging to remove and a bit harder to detect. So sometimes if you have several of those, they actually want you to come back sooner to be screened again, just to make sure that they've not redeveloped.
It's an outpatient procedure.
It is an outpatient procedure. Just show up with your friend to make sure you have a ride home, and you're good to go for a few years if all's good.
What is the difference between anal cancer and the colorectal? Because there's a difference there, isn't there?
Definitely. So anal cancer is the very, very beginning of the, entering through the rectum, it's the very beginning of the anal canal. And it is basically the majority of cases are squamous cell carcinoma. About 90% of those cases are squamous cell carcinoma. Those cases are treated with combined chemotherapy with radiation for a short period. And it's a different type of treatment, because these patients, if it's successful, then they go straight to surgery. They don't go to surgery.
Okay.
Unlike rectal carcinoma, where we do provide combined chemo radiation therapy, but we're likely going to recommend that you go to surgery. That is the standard of care. Squamous cell is very receptive to radiation therapy. And as a result, you can get a complete response or complete cure just with combined chemo radiation therapy alone. So it's very unique in that setting.
Okay.
It's not as common as mm-hmm. colorectal cancer, but it's also a very important cancer. And it's actually one of the cancers I treat.
Is it? And is that one that can be caused by HPV?
Correct.
Right? Okay.
It is, for the large part, associated with HPV. Probably about 90% of all cases, same HPV that's associated with cervical cancer as well as oropharyngeal or head and neck cancer.
And HPV is the
human papillomavirus.
Right. Okay. I say right, like I'm quizzing you. We are talking with Dr. Kathy Ang, who is a gastrointestinal medical oncologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center and also the founder of the annual Scope 5K, which is the Sprint for Colorectal Oncology Prevention and Education, which is coming up March 25th. And we're talking about colorectal cancer. And we keep talking about early diagnosis and screening. This is very important to start it when you are 50. But what about if you're having symptoms, and what are symptoms like?
That's very, very important. I'm glad you bring that up, because obviously a lot of patients are diagnosed before 50. Mm-hmm. And obviously, even if you're close to 50 and you're thinking about screening but you haven't done it yet, you should be aware of the symptoms. So it could be anything as simple as a change of bowel habits, basically noticing some blood in your stool, noticing the size of the stool is different, noticing how frequently you're going to the bathroom or not going to the bathroom. If you're having any pain, obviously, of the rectum while you're having a bowel movement, that would be concerning. More advanced signs would be loss of weight, obviously, night sweats. On laboratory tests, you'll be found to be very anemic in some cases. Sometimes some people don't even know they have colorectal cancer just maybe a week or two before, because they had one symptom and that resulted in additional diagnostic testing. But it's really important, I think, to listen to your body. And if you feel that something is becoming more chronic and doesn't go away with time, you should address it. Even things such as having passing gas, if you're noticing that much more than normal, and you don't think it's related to your foods, that would be a very important thing to share with your doctor.
It's important to listen to your body and not to feel ridiculous if you go into the doctor and say, hey, I've been passing a lot of gas lately. And they'll, you know, okay, well, let's look into that. Let's see. That's part of it.
No, I mean, I hate to say it. My mom was diagnosed with rectal carcinoma. Unfortunately, she's passed away due to another cause. But she actually had told her doctor for about 6 months that she had noticed increased gas. Mm-hmm. And he basically... She was older, but she'd never been screened. Even though she's my mom and she knows what I do, she just didn't want to be screened. She's a very traditional Chinese woman, and mm-hmm. it wasn't in her she wasn't comfortable undergoing colonoscopy, even though my dad had undergone multiple colonoscopies in the past. And basically, her doctor just gave her some Gas X and thought that it was really nothing. And in fact, she had rectal cancer.
Yeah. And so many people are so afraid of this, but it really, the experience of having one is not terrible.
A colonoscopy, right.
Yeah.
It's really not. And I'll be honest with you, I've had two colonoscopies myself. I'm not yet 50. But I was...
And you just did it for fun.
Yeah, I just did it for fun. You know, I was having symptoms about 10 years ago. I'm a runner, and it ended up being nothing. And then I just had another one recently just because my mom's history, and we just felt it was about time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. Well, you know, physician, heal thyself. You have to be able to do that. If you're going to make people do it, then you should be able to
right.
do it.
Right, and honestly...
It wasn't bad.
I survived the prep.
Yeah, there you go. So the importance of screening is so important. Let's say that there is something, that you do find something. And so somebody has been told that there's an issue. What's the first thing that they need to do? What's the first thing that happens?
If the biopsy comes back positive, the most important thing, obviously, is you need to identify a relationship or create a relationship with the medical oncologist you're comfortable with, as well as a surgeon, if it's early stage. And obviously, we would hope that would be the case. If it's rectal cancer, we also need to engage the radiation oncologist. But this is largely a multidisciplinary disease, and we really want to get the best doctors on board discussing your case before anything occurs.
When somebody comes up positive for this, there's a team that is assembled on your side, and there are so many different kinds of treatments and therapies and things. Tell me about some of the different ways that you treat it.
So for colorectal cancer, at least for early stage colon, usually it's surgery. And then following surgery, depending upon if there's any lymph node involvement, you may get some additional chemotherapy as long as you don't have, once again, as long as it's early stage disease. If there's a lymph node that's positive, you will get potentially additional therapy to prevent the risk of recurrence. For early stage rectal cancer, it is combined chemotherapy with radiation traditionally, unless you go on a clinical trial. And once again, we always encourage clinical trials because that's how we make advances. But the standard of care is concurrent chemoradiation therapy, followed by surgery for rectal cancer, and then usually additional chemotherapy.
Yeah, and you go through the testing and figure out the difference, what the stage is, and mm-hmm. things like that. What about survivability?
So I'm so glad you brought this up again because the colonoscopy is really the key here, right? We're trying to prevent it. But if you're diagnosed early enough, you could have a very long 5-year survival. It can range, once again, with no lymph node involvement. Your 5-year survival could be 80%, but with lymph node involvement, depending upon how many lymph nodes were involved, that can be reduced to anywhere between 50 to 75 to 80%. But for stage 4 patients, which means that it's spread elsewhere, their 5-year survival is reportedly about 13% now.
Yeah, so you don't cure it.
We can cure stage 4 disease if the disease comes back in focal sites, meaning specifically a couple sites in the liver, potentially a couple sites in the lung. So it has to be very limited recurrence, and it has to be accessible to the surgeon for removal. In some cases with lung involvement, we'll utilize radiation therapy. And in some cases, if the patient's not a good candidate for surgery and they have liver involvement, we'll also use some type of radiation therapy. So actually, their survival can still be as high. Instead of just being 13% for a stage 4 patient, their survival can go up as high as 65% if it can be resected or addressed for limited metastatic disease.
And it's just case-by-case basis, person-by-person. It completely manifests itself differently.
Correct. And then once again, in that setting, you need multidisciplinary management, the medical oncologist, and either a surgeon that's familiar with liver surgery or a thoracic surgeon. But for those patients, unfortunately, diagnosed with stage 4 disease that have diffuse metastatic disease, then they're once again, the traditional treatment is only going to be likely chemotherapy.
Tell me how treatment has changed over the years. There have been some different things that have been introduced.
Oh, definitely. For decades, there was only one drug called 5-FU before, and they used to only give it IV, and they used to only just change the schedule to find some different ways to make it more effective. But since the early 2000s, we've had two new chemotherapeutic agents approved, both in combination with the drug 5-FU to make it much more effective and in regards to response for patients. One of the drugs is called oxaliplatin. The other drug is called irinotecan. And that combination itself with 5-FU, one or the other drugs, increases the response rate as high as 35-45%. And then we have targeted agents now, specifically bevacizumab, which focuses on the blood supply of the tumor, the receptor of that. And then there's other drugs if, once again, it's appropriate for the patient, because we now are checking for mutations in the tumor types. But there's something called a KRAS mutation that's present in about 35 to 50% of patients, and additional other rare RAS mutations in about 13 to 16% of patients. So if you have one of those mutations, you can't receive the next class of drugs called anti-EGFR or anti-epidermal growth factor receptor antibodies, also known as cetuximab and panitumumab. If you don't have that mutation, you can receive that class of drugs, and that's another drug that can be either given by itself or in combination with chemotherapy. And the latest and greatest things, basically everyone has an interest in immunotherapy. But we're also looking at other more rare mutations in colon cancer and trying to find additional drugs specific to those mutations as well.
So that's when you're actually testing the tumor or yes. the actual cancer itself for the genetics, I guess, of the cancer. Is that right? Or the what?
Well, these are somatic mutations, so changes that occur over time in the tumor. They're not necessarily the germline mutations, which means that it had an inherited form of it. Now, there's a lot of interest right now in something called MSI-high, which means microsatellite instability. And MSI-high means that they have a defect in their mismatch repair protein, their DNA mismatch repair protein. Very small number of patients in stage 4 disease that have MSI-high. It's less than 5%. But now, based upon some very pivotal data that came out of Hopkins, and we're actually validating in several other trials, not only our institution, but in collaboration with other institutions, these national trials, looking at the role of immunotherapy, specifically in those MSI-high patients. It was quite interesting. Immunotherapy traditionally by itself in a run-of-the-mill colorectal cancer doesn't have a good response. It has a 0% response rate. But specifically in MSI-high patients with colon cancer, they looked at 10 patients in the initial study, and 4 of those 10 patients had a beautiful response.
So this is the first time that that's had any effect.
Yeah, that was 2015 was a big press piece about the role of immune therapy in patients with MSI-high tumors. So now it is actually, and it's we've been doing it for many years at our institution, but now it's a national recommendation that all patients diagnosed with colorectal cancer be tested for MSI-high, just in case they have that potential of benefiting from immunotherapy or immune checkpoint inhibition. And also, if you're a young patient, you should definitely be tested for it, because it may suggest you have a familial form of colorectal cancer. And that's also known as Lynch syndrome. It's not just associated with colorectal cancer. It's also associated with other cancers. And so that would it'd be a good way to recognize the importance of screening for other cancers in your family members. Mm-hmm.
And so immunotherapy basically that just kicks up your immune system, right? That's very basic.
But it's a nice way to put it, though. I mean, it's correct. It's utilizing your own immune system to help fight the cancer. And there's some immune checkpoint inhibitors that have been approved in lung cancer, that have been approved in melanoma. And now specifically, there's one called pembrolizumab that's approved currently for these MSI-high patients. But once again, there's a lot of clinical trials ongoing. And actually, there's some interesting data that shows that another company that owns one of these, what we call PD-L1 or programmed death ligand, the immune checkpoint inhibitor, there's a trial that is ongoing, a phase 3 trial, so it's much more advanced, and hopefully if it's positive, it'll go for FDA approval. But they've shown that in run-of-the-mill colorectal carcinoma patients, even though traditionally immune checkpoint inhibitors don't have a response by itself, when combined with another drug called a MEK inhibitor, it appears to be extremely promising, and they had a 20% response rate in run-of-the-mill colorectal cancer patients.
How does a cancer patient get into a clinical trial? That's kind of a process, isn't it?
It is. It is. And so there are various websites, obviously, MD Anderson, just because we are such a large institution, we obviously have access to a lot of the clinical trials, but obviously across the country, most larger cancer centers have access to clinical trials. And I think it's just really important for people to search the web, look for clinical trials. They go through different phases. There's phase one, phase two, and phase three. Phase three is the most advanced development of the clinical trial. Usually it's compared to what's the standard of care at the time. So it's something that's promising and investigational, and hopefully if it's positive, it goes for FDA approval at that point. But there's a lot of inclusion and exclusion criteria for a clinical trial, but we really encourage patients, if possible, to get interested and consider a clinical trial early on in their treatment, because that's when they're likely to feel their best and likely to be able to be accepted into a clinical trial. One of the things that has been a bit disconcerting for a lot of us lately is that we've not been able necessarily to get some clinical trials approved for patients. We have to go through a lot of paperwork with insurance companies to get approval. And it's just very challenging. We don't understand why the drug is free. The only thing the insurance company pays for is the standard tests, which includes some regular blood work, the physician visits, and a regular CAT scans, which are commonly done at intervals every two to three months for patients. But, you know, insurance providers are making it a bit harder for patients, and yet these patients really need these trials, because in the U.S., unfortunately, so few patients go on to clinical trials. It's reportedly anywhere between 2 and 5% in the nation. Whereas if you go to England, about 20, 25% of patients go on clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And these are how drugs get approved. If you go on a trial and it's positive, then it goes to the next step. And then it goes to the next step. And then it'll go to the FDA. So every single drug we have available to us currently is because other patients chose to participate in a clinical trial to help others.
Incredibly frustrating when you're in the research and treatment of different kinds of diseases to be able to have the, it's so close and you want to be able to go forward with it, but there's a roadblock there.
Oh yes, it's extremely frustrating, and it's even more frustrating when there's so much time that's gone by, and unfortunately the patient has advanced disease and his disease is progressing, and at some point we've had instances where patients aren't well enough to go on the trial because they've been waiting and waiting and waiting.
And it developed past the point.
Correct. Yeah.
Tell me about testing and vaccination. Is there any testing or research for maybe a vaccine for?
There are different trials for colorectal cancer currently, but there's not really one that's a standard of care. Mm-hmm. They have tried it in the past and it was not successful, but there are different types of vaccines that are in development. They're not as much in development as probably immunotherapy and other combined treatments with other targeted agents.
Okay. And so we have been talking with Dr. Kathy Eng. She's a professor of gastrointestinal medicine oncology. She's an oncologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center, also the founder of the Scope 5K, which is coming up March 25th. And if you want to participate in that, does it go for funding for research or what's
so,
the...
So we do try to collect funds. Actually, we have, we do special awards, obviously, for young participants. We have what's called an Aaron Scott Courageous Spirit Award that we try to fund that as well to give out plaques. And for the kids, we give out a bunch of, every kid has a medal at the end of the race. The intent at the end of the day is to collect enough money to start some small research grants for individuals interested in colorectal cancer research.
And you can participate just by donating. You don't have to go down to the 5K, right?
Correct. You can go to the website. Once again, it's www.mdanderson.org/scope. And the other thing we also contribute to, besides trying to create grants, is that we do create education packets that go out to the local churches, to the local YMCA, to educate individuals about colorectal cancer screening.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Kathy Eng. Thank you very much. And if you are listening, go and get screened.
Yes, please. I would appreciate it.
Colonoscopies for everybody.
Save a life.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to FYI. My name is Susie Hanks.